Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the October edition of Chemistry World's podcast with Victoria Gill, Richard Van Orden and Onno Bhattacharya. I'm Chris Smith. Coming up, how a drug that was originally intended to tackle anxiety has now found a new lease of life combating cancer.
What this does give the researchers is sort of a new paradigm for cancer drug design. So they have a small molecule that they know a lot about. They've sort of toxicity tested it. They've got it to early stage clinical trials. So they could use that to design new cancer drugs that interact specifically with this messenger.
You can hear how it works shortly. Also on the way, bisphenol A. It's in tin cans and plastic bottles, and that means it's probably also in us. But is it dangerous?
What we know from animal research is if you take young animals and you feed them that amount of bisphenol A, you have brain damage, reproductive damage, immune damage, liver damage. You damage virtually every system in the body.
That's Fred von Saal, who'll be explaining why you shouldn't boil your baby bottles later in the program. We've also got the answer to another organic nuisance.
This is some very nifty chemistry. A catalyst and a reagent combination together used to break down the famously strong, very inert carbon-fluorine bond at room temperature. Fluorocarbons are persistent organic pollutants. They do build up in penguins. If they're gases, they do build up in the atmosphere. And they are potent greenhouse gases.
Plus, if you cast your mind back to last month's autumnal chemical conundrum,
if you lived 100 years ago, which seasonal British fruit would you associate with the atom?
So if you sent in a fruity suggestion, then you could be one of this month's winners. The answer's on the way.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First this week, scientists have found, Victoria, that a drug originally intended to knock anxiety on the head actually does a much better job at blocking the overgrowth of cancer cells, and in an entirely novel way.
Yeah, exactly. A failed drug, it would seem, at the sort of clinical level that they thought had effects on anxiety. And now it turns out that it could be used to treat cancer in a brand new way that hasn't been seen before. So this is work that comes out of the University of Helsinki, Paavo Kinnunen and his group. And the drug was already being tested at sort of very early clinical stages. And it's called ceramicine. It acts at the cellular level on a specific receptor on the cell membrane. And that was what they were hoping would have the effect against anxiety, as a particular receptor on neurons. But at the clinical level, it just didn't seem to work.
So how did they then decide to apply it to cancer?
As you know, with testing a drug from the very early stages of discovery right through to approval costs a lot of money. So if you find that your drug fails at a very early stage, you might want to look into another effect that it might have. So looking at it in cell cultures, they found that it has an anti-cancer effect. It seems to prevent cancer cells from proliferating or sort of reproducing themselves.
Do they know how?
Yes, they do. And it's a brand new way that hasn't been seen before. It interacts with a second messenger molecule, a phospholipid on the cell membrane. And this phospholipid is a second messenger to stimulate a biochemical pathway that causes the tumour cells to proliferate. And it binds and interacts with this phospholipid, which is called phosphatidic acid, and prevents this second messenger from being used so the cancer cells can't reproduce.
I can see that being really useful. But one worry is, if all cells use this mechanism, will it not have terrible side effects?
Potentially, and that's always a problem with quite harsh, sort of cytotoxic, cell-killing cancer drugs. But what this does give the researchers is sort of a new paradigm for cancer drug design. So they have a small molecule that they know a lot about. They've sort of toxicity tested it. They've got it to early stage clinical trials. So they could use that to design new cancer drugs that interact specifically with this messenger. And they can sort of design out the side effects.
Thanks, Vic. So that's very exciting. Let's hope that that makes its way into the clinic soon. And talking of people discovering new drugs, Onno, this is very exciting. It looks like there's a new way for people to determine whether or not the thing that they think is targeting certain structures on cells is actually working or not.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. It's an invention of researchers in France. They've come up with a biosensor that can tell you if your drug is binding to the right sort of target on a cell. That could be tremendously useful for the pharmaceutical industry because it would allow them to screen large numbers of drugs very directly and quickly. And what they did to come up with this is that they got a protein called G-protein coupled receptor. It's a very common target for many, many drugs. I think about 30% of all drugs bind to this receptor. And they couple that to another protein called an ion channel. And this ion channel regulates the flow of ions in and out of cells. Now, what they did with the clever piece of genetic engineering is that they linked the two so that when a drug bound to the G-protein coupled receptor, it tugged on the ion channel, opened it up, the ions flowed, and you got an electric current, which they could then measure.
So you can work out exactly how active the drug is at the cell surface. So you've effectively got an objective readout here.
Yeah, it's all very direct and very, very sensitive. I mean, at the moment, what the pharmaceutical industry does is they have various indirect methods, like they use radioactive tags or fluorescent tags on their compound, and they see whether it's binding roughly to the protein that they're interested in. Or what they do is they monitor a cell and see if it's producing the sort of biochemical changes in the cell that they'd expect. But this sensor is, you know, it could offer a much more direct way of seeing if that drug's working.
Is this something which could be used tomorrow? Or is this really just proof of principle and it's going to be ages before we can really see drugs being produced because of this?
I suspect it's more of the latter. I think there's a way to go. For example, one of the questions raised by a scientist that we talked to was that, well, what happens if your drug is triggering the ion channel? You know, how do you know? You're going to have to try and differentiate between that and the G-protein coupled receptor.
So good news for the pharmaceutical sector. Thank you, Onono. Something that all new parents take very seriously is food hygiene. Most people obsessively sterilise their baby's bottles, often by nuking them in the microwave for 10 minutes or soaking them in boiling water. I'm one of them. But now some scientists are saying that the baby might be better off taking its chances with the bacteria rather than the bisphenol A that's leaking out of the plastic. Here's Fred von Saal.
Bisphenol A is a chemical that's used to make hard, clear, reusable plastic products that are used as food containers, sport water bottles, baby bottles, microwavable safe containers for food, also to line food and beverage cans. And it's used in many, many other applications. There's 7 billion pounds of this manufactured and put into products a year. But our main concern is its use as a food contact item, where we think the greatest human exposure is coming from. And based on data from Europe and Asia and the United States, virtually everyone has detectable levels of bisphenol A in his or her body, and that, of course, is a very serious concern.
Why is it so ubiquitously used in the ways you've just described?
Actually, it doesn't need to be. All of the products that are made with bisphenol A in countries like Japan, practically all of them have been replaced, particularly the food contact items. It's not used to line cans anymore. This is a chemical that became used extensively at a time that people did not understand that it is structurally very similar to the estrogen drug diethylstilbestrol, DES, and has the same activity of the natural estrogen produced in a person's body. So we refer to this as an endocrine disrupting chemical, and it acts like a sex hormone when it breaks out of the polymer that forms this hard, clear, odorless, tasteless material. The problem is that it is quite unstable when heated, and people are told that they can take baby bottles, for instance, and stick them in boiling water. Well, there are plenty of data out there now that when you do that, you break apart the bisphenol A molecules out of this polycarbonate plastic, and the baby is then drinking bisphenol A along with its baby formula.
On a normal day-to-day basis, what sort of dose are we getting?
Well, there's consensus for babies drinking baby formula out of baby bottles. They're getting somewhere between 2 and 14 micrograms per kilogram per day. What we know from animal research is if you take young baby animals and you feed them that amount of bisphenol A, you have brain damage, reproductive damage, immune damage, liver damage. You damage virtually every system in the body. And among other things, those animals become obese. They go into early puberty. So you have metabolic derangement as well. So this is a chemical that, particularly in early life, causes a tremendous amount of harm.
And if you look at the health risks and published clinical data on people who have been exposed, is the clinical data bearing out what you're saying?
So last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, David Meltzer's group in England published a study based on the United States National Health Survey showing that the higher your levels of bisphenol A, the more likely you were to show elevated insulin levels, elevated glucose levels, insulin resistance, liver damage, and cardiovascular disease, including the higher probability of dying of a heart attack.
What about the alternatives? Because if you're saying that out east people have an alternative and bisphenol A is not used, what do they use instead? And what's the evidence that that's any safer?
There are other kinds of polymers that are made from chemicals like polyether sulfone, which is sulfone molecules linked together that are highly resistant to breaking down under heat or acidic or basic conditions, such as heating up in a can tomato sauce, where you get this massive amounts of bisphenol A being found. So if you have a stable material that is not going to leach out into the food, it is going to be inherently safer, even though it may be as a molecule potentially as dangerous as bisphenol A. If you're not exposed to it, it doesn't pose a danger.
Well, that's certainly food for thought. That was Fred von Saal from the University of Missouri talking about the effects of bisphenol A that's leaking out of the things that we use to store food in. And if you'd like to follow up on the article that Fred mentioned, it's in the 17th of September 2008 edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how plants trick pollinators so they don't outstay their welcome, two new ways to battle drug-resistant bacteria, and IVF on a chip. First, though, Richard, scientists have found a way to break down persistent organic pollutants, including the notorious carbon-fluorine bond.
Exactly. This is some very nifty chemistry. A catalyst and a reagent combination together used to break down the famously strong, very inert carbon-fluorine bond at room temperature. It's from Oleg Ozerov's group at Brandeis University in Massachusetts. And fluorocarbons are persistent organic pollutants. They do build up in penguins. If they're gases, they do build up in the atmosphere. And they are potent greenhouse gases.
Why do they build up?
Well, it's very, very hard to break down that carbon-fluorine bond. Very inert. So they just hang around for thousands of years. There's no natural process by which they could ever be broken up into smaller pieces.
And what has this team done to try and solve the problem?
This team had earlier shown that if you got a very strong Lewis acid, a cation that pulled electrons away from the carbon-fluorine bond, you could get that bond to break. But unfortunately, that was very short-lived. I mean, it broke a few and then that was it.
It's also not very practical on a global scale, given these things are accumulating in the atmosphere and in the sea, to do that, is it?
Well, the idea here would actually be to try and store what you've got and break it down in a reactor. They haven't yet got to the stage of deciding what to do about the things that have already built up. But for this chemistry, they'd already shown that an acid could break down the carbon-fluorine bond. It didn't hang around long. Here, they've got another strong silyl cation. It's actually a silylium, a silicon surrounded by three other groups, which is a cation. And there's a balancing counterion, a carborane, which doesn't really get in the way much. So the cation is free to pull away the fluorine from the carbon-fluorine bond. That leaves you with the positively charged carbon. And they've got another reagent coming in, triethyl silane, which is a positively charged silicon, but you've got hydrogen on the end making it a molecule. And that hydrogen is taken by what was your carbon-fluorine bond. You end up with a hydrocarbon, a carbon-hydrogen bond. That's much better for the environment. Now, your catalyst will then churn over, your reagents being used up, and you'll end up with fluorine, instead of being bonded to carbon, being bonded to silicon. And the researchers say that that has less of an impact on the atmosphere.
So what is the resulting product?
Silicon surrounded by hydrocarbons with a fluorine atom attached to it. Previously, you had fluorine attached to carbon.
And they say this is better for the environment. It's less of a greenhouse gas than the carbon-fluorine bond we had there before.
Yes, they do.
But what about environmental safety to animals, to humans, that kind of thing?
Well, the idea would not be to let this stuff leak out into the environment. It may indeed turn out to be toxic. But the idea that there's clever chemistry, that you can break down this bond, is what really excites them. Now, they haven't tried this on a kilogram scale. We are just talking catalyst, lab scale, good turnover. But it's just extremely amazing that at room temperature, you can actually break down this strong bond.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see what the long-term future holds for that particular bit of chemistry. Thanks, Richard. Now, Victoria, back on to something which is very much an issue that's been going on for thousands of years, and that's pollination of plants. And scientists have got to the bottom of how plants manage to sort out the wheat from the chaff, if you like.
Indeed. And it seems that they use a kind of clever bit of chemistry to trick their pollinators. This is work that comes out of the Max Planck Institute for Chemical Ecology in Jena. And Ian Baldwin and his team have discovered that plants use a very finely tuned mixture of attractants and repellent chemicals to sort of tease pollinators in to pollinate them and take their nectar.
So on the one hand, they're attracting them,
yes,
by giving them something nice.
Yes.
And at the same time, repelling them.
Yes, and then using a sort of toxic chemical to repel them, to make them go away before they've taken all the nectar, and so that other pollinators will have a chance to pollinate the plants. That way they get to reproduce more successfully.
Okay, so in other words, if you had something that was entirely attractive, a nice juicy flower full of nectar, then greedy insects might be tempted to just spend all day on one flower.
Yes.
And that would not fulfil any of the obligations of being a pollinator,
exactly,
because they wouldn't carry any pollen.
And then that flower wouldn't be able to sort of spread its seeds and reproduce as successfully as other plants.
So what did they do to prove this is what the plants were doing?
So they've been studying these particular tobacco plants for a long time now, and they've discovered that there are two chemicals that are the most important attractant and repellent chemicals. Benzyl acetone is their most important attractant, and nicotine is their most important repellent. And they'd used fake flowers with these particular chemicals on to show that these attracted and repelled pollinators, bees and hummingbirds. So using RNA interference, which is a method of sort of silencing a particular gene that makes a chemical, for example, they've silenced the genes that make benzyl acetone, the attractant, and that make nicotine, the repellent. And so they've generated plants that produce either just repellents or just attractants or a balanced mixture of the two. And they've videoed these plants to see how much they are visited by pollinators. And what they found is that the plants have to have this very delicate balance of the two chemicals in order to be visited by as many pollinators as possible.
Sneaky plants. You do have to wonder, though, whether the pollinators are actually hooked on the nicotine, and that's why they keep coming back. Thank you, Victoria. And now to the question of antibiotic resistance and the race to develop new drugs to combat bacteria that are becoming increasingly more difficult to deal with. Thankfully, now scientists have got two new targets to aim at. Here's Robert Fesik.
Well, the issue addressed by the two papers is the lack of new antibacterial drug targets. It's been widely recognized that there has been a lack of new antibiotics in the drug industry pipeline. Part of the problem has been a dearth of new drug targets that could be exploited for antibacterial drugs. And so in these two papers, the authors have set out to try to establish or validate certain drug targets that could be exploited for antibacterial therapy.
So briefly, how do these two new targets that they've uncovered work? What approaches do they take which are different to those antimicrobials that we already have to throw at patients at the moment?
In the first paper, this was published by scientists at Prolysis, they have identified a protein called FTSZ. Sometimes it's referred to as FTSZ. This is a protein that is critical for cell division in bacteria, and so this is very vital for them to grow. And this protein, FTSZ, attracted a lot of attention because it turns out that this is the homologous protein in bacteria to tubulin in mammals. And tubulin is a well-known anti-cancer drug target. This is the target of drugs such as Taxol, vinblastine, vincristine. And so the idea is that if this tubulin protein is effective to stop cancerous cells growing, then the homologous protein in bacteria should also be an effective antibiotic treatment to stop bacteria from growing.
How do the bacteria use the protein?
This FTSC protein forms what is called the Z-ring, and the protein polymerizes to form a ring on the inside of the bacterial cell wall as it's undergoing cell division. And the presence of this ring then helps to recruit other proteins to this ring site that enables the process of cell division to occur.
Oh, right. So this is how bacteria quite literally split in two when they undergo binary fission and one bacterium becomes two.
Correct.
So how does this agent actually affect that protein and therefore stop the bacteria dividing?
So the compound reported in this study has the codename PC190723. This compound actually prevents the FTSC protein from polymerizing. So you can think of it as an agent that blocks the formation of this Z-ring. This essentially shuts down the key event that needs to take place for bacteria to divide and grow.
So we know that this new agent works, and it can stop the bacteria from dividing, presumably, or has this just been done in vitro?
In the current study, the authors have taken this one step beyond in vitro work that others have demonstrated and have now taken this into an in vivo mouse model of bacterial infection. And, for instance, they found that upon single injection over a seven-day time period that this compound that inhibits FTSE polymerization cures mice of a lethal infection.
And is this target found in all kinds of bacteria, or are there certain subtypes of bacteria, and therefore it's not going to be a panacea for everything, it will only cure some certain infections with certain types of bacteria?
So FTSC is almost entirely conserved amongst all bacteria, and so presumably this could be a very broad spectrum type of antibiotic. However, one interesting thing that's been found by a number of groups is that compounds that inhibit FTSC polymerization are generally more effective against gram-positive organisms. And so the most clinically significant of these are multidrug-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, infections. And so this tends to lead to some hope that perhaps an agent such as this could be a targeted type of antibacterial infection that could be reserved for multidrug-resistant infections, particularly gram-positive ones.
And let's face it, we certainly need some. So that's one of the publications. There was a second paper. This was the group in Japan, and they've been looking at a slightly different target.
Yes, and so the group in Japan, Toru Dari, they have been looking at a protein called menaquinone, and this is a protein that plays a critical role in bacterial respiration, and so bacteria need proper functioning of this to survive. However, they found that there are certain strains of H. pylori, or this is the bacteria which commonly causes stomach ulcers, that they use an alternate pathway. And so they actually produce a different type of protein critical for bacterial respiration. And so this suggests, again, getting back to the theme of selective antibacterial agents or targeted antibacterial agents, that interfering with this pathway that has only so far been found in H. pylori, that this could be a selective antibiotic agent useful for the treatment of stomach ulcers.
So another promising target, but how long do you think it will take before this one and the previous agent that we've talked about will actually find their way into patients?
It will likely be a number of years before any agents from these studies could be translated into clinical useful therapies. Establishing in vivo animal efficacy data is one of the essential early steps. And so there's much work to be done here. For instance, we know nothing about long-term toxicity of these agents, potential side effects, and other types of infections that these compounds could be potentially useful in. And so it would likely be 3 to 5 years potentially till a new agent at this stage could enter human clinical trials.
That's Robert Fesik from the University of Minnesota. You're listening to the Chemistry World podcast, and coming up shortly, how scientists have built an atomic-scale pinball machine and the answer to this month's chemical conundrum. But first, good news for IVF, because scientists have developed a technique that might help to boost the success rate of the procedure by helping them to identify the healthiest embryos. On a note, what's this about?
Yes, Chris. So these scientists at MIT have come up with a postage stamp sized device, which they say could help to determine whether an IVF embryo is healthy prior to implantation.
How's it work?
Well, what they've got is a microfluidic chip, and it measures the nutrients that an embryo is taking in. And at the moment, it measures three key nutrients, glucose, pyruvate, and lactate. Now, when these nutrients get taken in, they're catalyzed by an enzyme called nitrite reductase, or NADPH. And this enzyme fluoresces in its reduced form. So what they've done is they've found a way of picking up on that light, and they use that to tell whether the embryo is healthy or not.
So in other words, they're using this as an indirect measure of health, because by measuring the metabolic profile of the embryo, in other words, its ability to break down those three substances, you can tell whether or not it's within the normal range of biochemical parameters.
That's exactly what they're trying to do, yeah, although it's all a bit controversial at the moment. I mean, they claim at the moment they've only done it with mouse cells, mouse embryos, so they haven't yet applied it to humans. They seem to think that's not too difficult. But then researchers we contacted said that the three metabolites they'd chosen, the three nutrients, hadn't really been linked to the viability of the embryo later. They need to demonstrate that the nutrients that they've shown actually correlate well with whether an embryo will grow or not.
And also in different species, because this is a proof of principle, presumably mice and small rodent work. Is it likely that a human embryo, much bigger, could be an entirely different ballpark?
Yeah, yes, it might be. I mean, as I say, the researchers are confident that they can use basically the same technology with human embryos. But it sounds like they're going to have to look at a completely different spectrum of nutrients and metabolites to get this right.
Well, there's still an important step forward, because at the moment it's taking guesswork and at least putting some numbers on it, because that's what it is. The present technique is nothing more than really guesswork under a microscope. It's an educated guess.
Yeah, at the moment about 25% of IVF embryos are successfully implanted, so any device that can help get that number up is going to be very welcome.
Especially with the price tag being what it is for IVF. Thanks, Olano. And Richard, let's get even smaller now and down at the level of individual atoms. This sounds extraordinary, how you can turn platinum atoms into the equivalent of a pinball game.
Yep, that's right. Remember the pinball flippers in the old games? You don't see them around anymore. But Harold Zandvliet and colleagues at the University of Twente have discovered a little atomic version of these pinball flippers. What they did was they had platinum atoms deposited onto a germanium surface, trying to make nanowires. And you got all these atoms, and they actually sort of make dimers. They sort of collect together in pairs. When they were inspecting these atoms with a scanning tunneling microscope, a tip comes down, electrons stream from the tip onto the surface, and they actually found that some of these pairs were flipping, pivoting up and down like flippers. And you could actually get two next to each other flipping in synchrony or not in synchrony. Incredible that you can show that something on the atomic scale, you can have what is effectively a switch from outside causing this flipper-like, machine-like motion.
Bizarre, but why does it do it?
Well, they have no idea why it does it, and they have no idea how to recreate getting these pairs on the surface. But of course they have their suspicions, and they've done some experiments to try and find out why. And what they think is that in the germanium subsurface underneath these pairs of platinum atoms, you do have missing atoms sometimes. And they reckon that the platinum atom above this vacancy is allowed to swing free. The other platinum atom is fixed and acts as a pivot. But this could just be a chance thing. They also don't know how the current coming in causes that swinging to happen. It's very exciting, it's very intriguing, but they really have no idea beyond that at this stage. But it's one of those discoveries that it's just so intriguing that you could get atomic scale machinery.
Does the frequency it flips at tell you anything about the structure of the surface or the chemistry of what's going on?
They know that increasing the strength of the current increases the flipping frequency. I think that's as far as they've got.
And to finish up, Richard, how do they see this being used? Or do you think it's just one of those wonderful, terrific discoveries that looks great but actually isn't terrifically useful?
Well, Zandvliet says, and I quote, "We don't see any applications for it. We stumbled on it by luck. We immediately decided to work on it because it's an interesting feature." But let's get this in perspective. The ultimate idea of nanotechnology is to be able to make machines on the atomic scale. and this is a machine on the atomic scale. Now, of course, they can't control it, they can't get it where they want it, but it just shows the kind of thing that might be possible in 20, 30 years when we understand more about what's going on the atomic scale on the surface.
Thanks, Richard. Atomic pinball wizard Richard Van Orden. Now, Richard, talking of atoms, in last month's Chemical Conundrum, we wanted to know what seasonal fruit would have been associated with an atom about a century ago. So what's the answer?
Well, the answer was, as many of you got, a plum, referring to J.J. Thompson's model of the atom as a plum pudding, with the plums supposed to be surrounded by a morass of negative charge. And all that was changed by Rutherford when he famously bounced particles off the positive nucleus in the centre of the atoms in gold leaf, leading to the model that we know today.
Thank you, Richard. And well done to Keith Moore, Holly Atten, Tom Cronin and Victoria Blair, who were the first out of the hat this month. You've all won yourselves a Chemistry World goodie bag, very sought after. And if you'd like to win one next month, Victoria, what do you want to know from people?
Well, sticking with the Nobel theme, since it's October, it's 50 years since this scientist, the only scientist ever to have won two chemistry Nobel Prizes, won his first Nobel. What is his name and which protein would you associate him with? So could you please send your answers to chemistryworld@rsc.org, and please don't forget to include your name and address so that we can post you your goodie bag.
Oh, sneaky question. Thank you, Victoria. And you can also use that address to send us your thoughts and feedback about this or one of our previous Chemistry World podcasts. Don't forget that we also produce a weekly podcast called Chemistry in Its Element, where we take a look at the sinister side of the periodic table. You can find Chemistry in Its Element on iTunes or via our website. That's at chemistryworld.org/elements. Chemistry World was brought to you this month by Victoria Gill, Richard Van Orden and Onono Bhattacharya. The production was by Meera Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com, and I'm Chris Smith. Until next time, goodbye!
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.